This is Class 2 of an Introduction to the Essential Teachings of Trungpa Rinpoche. These talks were given at the Boulder Shambhala Center in the fall of 2009. The presenter of this evening's talk, titled Spiritual Materialism, is Clark Warren. The date is September 29th. We join Clark approximately 4 minutes into his talk.
The great sages of the ages were talking about, because everything was so convoluted in terms of translation, and so it was not easy to regard Eastern religion as a mystery. However, there was some clarity, but then John Visvedar gave me a book by Trungpa Rinpoche, first Born in Tibet, which was the history of his coming out of Tibet, but then Meditation in Action. And I was thoroughly amazed by both the simplicity and clarity of the book, and at the same time how it seemed to go to depth in terms of describing the nature of the Buddha's teachings. And this came close after having read a book of similar quality by Suzuki Roshi, the Zen master that Peter Boltz was talking about last week, called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. How many people here have read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind? Quite a few of you. How many people have read Meditation in Action? How many people have read both? So there was a sudden presence of clarity and yet profundity about the Buddhist tradition available seemingly for the first time in the English language. And following upon that, I was a member of a small Zen group in Boulder, which consisted of some people from Suzuki Roshi's group in San Francisco who'd come out here, and other people. And unlike Peter, who said he didn't particularly have an affinity with the cultural presentation of Zen, I was thoroughly attached to it. And Suzuki Roshi, in all his pristine Japanese aesthetic, was really wonderfully riveting for me. Not to mention that he also had an incredible clarity with regard to understanding the American mind. So, same time, John Visvedar suggested that we put a group together to invite Trungpa Rinpoche to come to the University of Colorado and teach. It was the 60s, and such things were possible, so we went to the university, and the university said, okay. And we invited Trungpa Rinpoche, who by that time had been in England for a while, and in Scotland. And we didn't hear anything. First month, second month. We thought we'd given a good presentation. John Visvedar put a little postcard of the Rocky Mountains in it and said, you know, this is perhaps similar to your homeland, and there's people here interested to hear the Buddhist teachings. And the third month passed and nothing happened, so about the third or fourth month we just thought, well, he's obviously not interested. We went back to our lives. That was that. Then we got a letter from Trungpa Rinpoche out of nowhere that said, thank you very much for your invitation. I will be coming for at least 2 years, not 2 weeks. So please make preparations. So we went about doing what we thought we should do to welcome a Tibetan Lama of repute who was said to be the rebirth of a famous teacher. We found a little cabin with no running water and just an outhouse up past Gold Hill, high in the mountains, and I can't think we envisioned that maybe 15 of us would spend our days meditating with him in this pristine environment up there, receiving the secrets of Tibetan Buddhism. The first thing that happened when he did get here was he stayed about 1 or 2 days there and then moved to a more suburban situation, which was still in the mountains, but a good deal more workable, comfortable. So things developed pretty quickly in terms, first of all, of Trungpa Rinpoche teaching at the University of Colorado, and then very quickly attracting an initial core group of students. And When I look back, it seemed like a long time as things developed, but now it seemed like they happened in a flash in a way, just in a matter of 1, 2, 3 years before there was a Buddhist community here. And then there was Naropa University and so many other things. So my particular bent was that I was still interested in the Asian aspect of things, and that kind of translated into looking at the Tibetan language translation and studying the Buddhist teachings somewhat academically, but very interested in what they meant in terms of experience, direct experience. And that's been my angle through the years, which has been both a curse and a blessing. Now, the situation in America, of course, that Trungpa Rinpoche encountered was one of turmoil and questioning and almost revolution in terms of spiritual curiosity about alternatives to Western approaches, particularly the approach of stark materialism. And, of course, the hippie movement, preceded by the beatnik movement, came as a reaction to the standard prescription for American materialism. So there was a natural tendency to want to look at things more spiritual and more meaningful than people encountered in their lives. And therefore there was a good deal of curiosity about Eastern religions and Buddhism. But I think when we look at who Trungpa Rinpoche met and interacted with, on one hand there were the hippies, but it was a much bigger circle than that. And Trungpa Rinpoche ran into, met, interacted with, communicated with, mutually nourished each other with many people from many walks of life, scholars, poets, artists, everyday working people, people in bars in rural Massachusetts who were bikers, Indians. He met two Native Americans who he regarded with equal stature to his own teachers in Tibet, and many, many other people. So his interactions and influence were not limited to one particular social group particularly, but nonetheless there was a certain quality in America. Somebody suggested one time that perhaps that quality of curiosity had been provoked by the use of psychedelic drugs, and he himself thought that it was much more basic than that, that that was just a sideline, but that there was much more of a basic opening in American culture and in the events of the world that provided an opening to look at such things as the Buddhist approach to spirituality. So even though I wasn't involved with a close circle of Trungpa Rinpoche students per se, I kind of fluttered around a little bit because of my shyness and my interests and my not being that interested in the kind of social positioning. Nonetheless, you know, I look back on one hand and I think I should have kicked myself and gone and spent more time with Trungpa Rinpoche when people could than I did. I think to myself, you should have just overcome your shyness and your reluctance and your political predispositions and just waded into it. And on the other hand, it seemed to me that I never felt for a moment that I didn't have a very personal connection with Trungpa Rinpoche's teachings. And there was an uncanny ability of Trungpa Rinpoche to give even a basic talk about a technical aspect of Buddhism and simultaneously feel like he was delving into your personal business. There's a story about the Buddha, Shakyamuni, that at one point he gave a very general teaching on what came to be the Buddhist Dharma teachings. And afterwards, a lady who had been in the audience listening to him came up and was quite irate, and she said, "How dare you talk about me so personally in public?" So I think there was definitely that quality with Trungpa Rinpoche. And perhaps the fact that he seemed to have delved so thoroughly with the basic condition of what it is to be human was how somebody, as Peter mentioned last week, could come out of the most remote part of the world and connect with the most populated and busy part of the world in such a direct and insightful way. So in looking at Trungpa Rinpoche's teaching, there was definitely a hallmark teaching that seemed to have come in like a tidal wave when he arrived in America. And that's the teaching on spiritual materialism, which, as Mr. Volz mentioned last week, seems to be a term that he coined. I tried to look or track down the translation of that in Tibetan. It doesn't seem to be there, but nonetheless, it seems, on the other hand, to be a key approach that instigates and recollects pretty much every fundamental teaching of the Buddhist approach to spirituality. And it was a quality of Trungpa Rinpoche that sometimes I wondered whether he was even Buddhist anymore, and he seemed to have, in his style of living, in his style of approaching America, seemed to have divorced himself from his own tradition. Seemed to be somewhat of a renegade. But later on, when we looked at his teaching in perspective with regard to the general Buddhist teachings, it became quite apparent that, as Peter mentioned again, he was quite traditional in a way, presenting very traditional Buddhist teachings, but in a way that was so incisive and so applicable and pertinent to the situation at hand, not only in those years, but at that day and that moment and that mood of people, that it seemed completely fresh and incisive and new. And Trungpa Rinpoche even made the remark many times that the quality of the Buddhist teachings is that they're always up to date. When Trungpa Rinpoche presented the approach that he did to working with what we call spiritual materialism, of course, you had a large group of people who started to gather around him who'd been quite frustrated with materialism, as we mentioned to begin with, and who were ravenous for something to divert themselves from the voracious appetite of American materialism. So in some way, people were looking for a way out or an alternative. And indeed, I think, you know, Buddhism and other approaches were called alternative religions. Maybe they still are. So on one hand, there was an open audience, open ears. This is exactly the subject we want to talk about, materialism. But I think the approach that he presented it with was quite shocking. And that was that in approaching the spiritual path, it was entirely possible and probable that exactly what you're trying to get rid of invades, infects, and spreads that very thing that you're trying to get away from. So in a way, Americans were trying to get away from the American ego, the American sense of identity with materialism. And yet, when Trungpa Rinpoche defined spiritual materialism, it was to take spiritual means and use them to reinforce the sense of ego and the qualities of ego which you seemingly want to get away from by entering into the spiritual path. But ironically, you're approaching the whole path from that very same point of view. And socially at the time, of course, you could point directly to that sentiment and hunger which was looking for an alternative, something mysterious, something from somewhere else that had developed purely outside of the scope of American materialism. And it was that very fascination and fixation and expectation that Trungpa Rinpoche addressed initially by taking his robes off and adopting the seemingly most urbane habits of American culture, smoking, drinking, etc. Somebody once said at a talk to Trungpa Rinpoche, they asked him, how can you defile the temple of the body by smoking cigarettes? And his answer was, I have a very big temple. So just like his seemingly renegade style and his diving into the accoutrements of being an American and seemingly away from what people expected, then he started to teach in that vein. And that is that unless you can cut through the fantasy and expectation that you have about Buddhism, then there's no way you can even begin a genuine spiritual path. You're just going to recirculate your fascination. You're going to recirculate your hunger. And that in itself is materialism. That's the even more fundamental materialism, is to solidify all the things you're trying to get away from in the form of a new packaging in terms of spirituality. So he was quite incisive and you might even say ruthless on occasion about smashing what he felt was this preoccupation with the fantasy about spirituality in general and Buddhism in particular, and particularly about Tibetan Buddhism, since it seemed to come with so many psychedelic sideshows that attracted people of the time. Strange paintings and strange colors and strange incantations and rituals, and the whole thing seemed to feed people's expectation for what a mysterious Eastern religion would be. And yet that was the first thing that he struck at, that fascination, that expectation. And for all apparent purposes, he seemed to have severed himself from his own roots. So that was the basic, that was the foundation. If you really want to enter a genuine spiritual path, you have to kind of come clean about what your motives are. And in fact, he would say, you better think about entering a spiritual path at all, because once you get involved with that spiritual path, it may be hard to drop it for the rest of your life, particularly the path of meditation. So you should really consider even getting involved at all. And one of the aspects of that was that by setting out on a spiritual path, rather than finding an alternative to this world, you're actually going to encounter an approach which is based on no escape, an approach based on heading right back into the wind of what you've been dealing with. And there's a very telling moment in a video of Trungpa Rinpoche's talk at Naropa University one summer, in which very long-haired, very bearded hippie, could have been any one of us here, I suppose, got up during the question and answer period and said, he looked totally puzzled and said, Rinpoche, let me get this straight. So you're saying to travel the spiritual path, we should cut our hair, get jobs, and enter fully into American society? And he said, that's right. And the poor fellow just said, oh, okay, and sat down, looking completely shocked. But that was basically the message. So the approach to spirituality wasn't that materialism was something to be escaped, but to be looked at. And that any attempt to escape was just furthering that same materialism and the basis for it. And in general, the approach to spirituality was to create an environment, both personally and in terms of the teachings, that was willing to experience the reality of one's life without any attempt to escape or without any attempt to feed anything further either. just to look at the way one's life was, which translated into the teaching of seeing things as they are. I was listening to an NPR interview the other day on the radio with a woman who has recently written a book called The Case for God named Karen Armstrong, and she's a religious scholar, a very interesting woman who's done an incredible amount of deep study into the world's religions. And at some point, Terry Gross asked her, what do you think religion is? What is this compulsion for religion and spirituality in human beings that seems to be there no matter what? No matter how one tries to suppress it or get rid of it. And she says, she said it's something in the human character that longs for something transcendental. And I thought to myself, I wonder whether she's looked at the Buddhist approach to spirituality. Because in a way, Buddhism is the opposite of transcendental. It's the opposite of looking for some kind of alternative or deeper or other approach to life or meaning. But rather, it's, to begin with, just settling down and taking inventory of what one life and what one's mind is about. Not particularly abstract, not particularly profound, but very basic. So in the climate of the 60s, of course, that was targeted towards what was going on, the fascination with spirituality and the longing for exotic forms of spirituality. And one time, I wasn't there, but somebody recollected to me a talk that Trungpa Rinpoche gave at the Unitarian Church at Gary and Franklin in San Francisco, the very same one there. Peter Voltz was saying last week that he heard Trungpa Rinpoche, in which he recited basically a very relentless litany of the things that will not work at all. And he basically said, you know, went through every possible approach to spirituality, well-being, psychotherapy that was current at the time in the major religions. Your Christianity is hopeless. Your Judaism is hopeless. Your atheism is hopeless. Your Rolfing is hopeless. And basically went through pretty much every possibility, which was lengthy in terms of especially San Francisco at the time, and just went through one by one. And finally, of course, also included Buddhism. He said, your Buddhism and your meditation is hopeless. And from what I understand, you know, the normally wide open liberal crowd of spiritual seekers in San Francisco attending his talk turned into an almost like a lynch crowd. And there was a bit of anticipation about whether Trungpa Rinpoche would make it out of there safely. So there was that kind of relentless attack on spiritual materialism. He was very straightforward about how if we're going to pursue the teachings of the Buddha at all, we're going to have to get this straight at first. We're going to have to cut through. We're going to have to defeat this addiction to spiritual materialism. We're going to have to understand that. Otherwise, we can't go any further. In that time, he proliferated other teachings which were reflections of spiritual materialism, perhaps stated in slightly different ways. So, for instance, he talked about the notion of Buddhism or Buddha Dharma without credentials, that your spiritual path had no possibility for credentials, no, as Suzuki Roshi would say, no gaining idea. And then, for a period of time, he was relentless in his writing on the teaching of hopelessness, in which he would just basically deconstruct any possible hope for spirituality helping you or getting you somewhere. And then it would obviously get to the point where people were wondering whether he was just completely cynical and nihilistic, but then he would go to that. He said, you know, if you're going to get depressed or nihilistic about that, that's also hopeless. And basically getting to the point where he said, you know, hopelessness goes far beyond hope and fear, or because even if you become despondent or depressed, that's still the expression of ego. That's still something that you're going to hang on to. So you really have to get to the point of utter hopelessness, beyond hope and fear, much less beyond any sense that you're going to be saved or that anything is going to change your life in a way that's going to make everything better. Now, Trungpa Rinpoche's teaching over the span of his life included every aspect of the Buddhist teaching, including those, as we came to know later, of Buddha nature and the basic sanity and intelligence of human beings, of all beings. And in terms of what we'll discuss later, of course, the notion of basic goodness. And you could say, well, what happened? Did he cheer up? Did he turn a corner quickly when the gas for that particular teaching had run out and refuel on a more optimistic outlook? Well, one thing I recall about Trungpa Rinpoche is he never made it simple in terms of connecting all the dots, even for a moment, much less trying to make the whole corpus of Buddhist teachings a seamless web that could be understood from different perspectives and everybody could be civilized and acceptable of each other's position. He really left it to people to work with the totality of the teachings and the seeming contradictions, in the same way that perhaps one has to work with their own being in terms of the seeming contradictions and yet the aspiration to be a whole person in some way. Even with spiritual materialism, he on one hand enjoined people to smash spiritual materialism, but he never really told us exactly how to do that. In terms of, well, you know, here's your hammer. And in fact, at one point he talked about being at a conference of Christians and Buddha, and he was the Buddhist representative in England at some point. And he was talking about the notion of sacred world as opposed to the Christian notion that was being presented, and how this world is inherently sacred and good. And there were several students there from Oxford or wherever who were really challenging the Christians there, who were getting pretty uptight about this kind of attack on the theology of Christianity and salvation. And really wanting Trungpa Rinpoche to kind of give them more ammunition to smash through this kind of westernized notion of salvation. And Trungpa Rinpoche accounted this himself. He said at some point everybody was supposed to give the evening blessing for the meal, so it came to his time to give it, and there was this expectation that he would do something kind of radical and rebellious at the time to kind of divert. And he got to the table, and everybody's a little bit tense, especially the Christians, and he says something like, basically, Jesus, bless this food, and let us, you know, let us worship you and with pure heart, all men. Something to that effect. So, nonetheless, it seemed at some point that we had an environment here in Boulder where he was teaching mostly, where the Sangha or the community of his practitioners felt more like a bunch of razor blades in a room just swiping at each other. And if you came into the center, you were more than likely to be confronted by somebody rather than welcoming you would say, what's your trip? So this environment of what it meant to cut through spiritual materialism was getting a little edgy, to say the least. And I remember going to Rinpoche and saying, Rinpoche, is this the point? We're supposed to be like a bunch of razor blades just cutting at each other? So whether that was a necessary step and intended, or whether he just let us have enough rope to hang ourselves, it seemed to be a quality of Trungpa Rinpoche that he would give a teaching but not necessarily explain how you're supposed to figure out or connect all the dots, but find out in your life what might be genuine about that teaching, what might not be genuine. And if you had to do that by hanging yourself from a rope for a while, then so be it. The lesson was all the more penetrating that way. And perhaps somebody else has a view on the matter. I'll never know whether that was a necessary step in terms of the teaching on cutting through spiritual materialism or not. Perhaps it was that stark cynicism that we went through. All the more shocking when within a year or so, he made a switch to what he called phase two, which he described as diving into the corniest of devotion without any reluctance. And so, having been thoroughly steeped in this idea of cutting through spiritual materialism, that was yet another shock, and perhaps we'll talk about that next week, that particular shock. But nonetheless, he seemed intent, and as it turned out, it was his intent to instill in us that basic sensibility of cutting through spiritual materialism, and I don't think it's ever left. It's a basic component of the approach to spirituality, the Buddhist path. And I think the notion is that once you familiarize yourself with that approach and it takes hold, then, in fact, it does become a fundamental element which informs every succeeding aspect of your life, in terms of the teachings or in terms of how you work with your world. Although it doesn't mean maybe keeping the same sense of the word. So, first of all, of course, it's necessary in the most outwardly way to ground oneself away from constantly looking towards some abstract goal, or to satisfy oneself with spirituality so that you don't feel threatened, so that you feel protected, so that somehow you envisage yourself as kind of coming to some point where you're a purely spiritual person and nothing ruffles you. Just the fact that Trungpa Rinpoche came to America and not somewhere else was evidence that cutting through spiritual materialism didn't mean ridding yourself of materialism. Some people wondered, you know, why didn't he just stay in the Himalayas and reconstitute his monastery in exile and live a peaceful life? Or why didn't he keep the 15 hippies up past Gold Hill and just give, you know, sequestered teachings on the... But at every opportunity, he seemed to just head right into the very heart of materialistic culture. So broadly speaking, that's the social context of the teaching on spiritual materialism. But then simultaneously, in a way, there was the meditative and the inner aspect, you might say, the personal aspect of spiritual materialism and how that becomes your approach to meditation and to approach to working with your life. As Mr. Volz noted last week, the necessity to cut through spiritual materialism doesn't seem to end in the Buddhist tradition until the final stage, where there's just a hair's breadth sense of separation from your innate wisdom. And still that hair's breadth of the most refined, of the most developed, of the most disciplined spiritual practitioner is said to be a monumental separation, so that it's said that once you're past that point and have completely cut the root of spiritual materialism, cut the root of ego, then the difference between that and the point that you were on the other side of it, where that was that hair, is the difference between a drop and an ocean. So there's that magnitude. And, of course, the whole notion of ego itself is an interesting one, because the teachings of egolessness would suggest that there's an ego to get rid of or to be less of. And believing that there's an ego itself is probably the most overt form of spiritual materialism. So even the project of having to become egoless is a bit suspicious from that point of view. And the project of feeling like you have to cut something at some point becomes a little bit concerned, because there's a certain ambition right there, a certain sense that, well, once I cut through spiritual materialism, then I'll arrive at the other side of spiritual non-materialism. And then it'll be okay. So the whole process becomes a little more subtle and tricky in a way. What am I doing anyway? From the point of view of the path, it seems that that brings up a certain sense of confusion and doubt, you might say, about what one's doing. When you get to the point where you're so sensitive to spiritual materialism that you don't even quite trust your own practice, your own involvement, your own inspiration. However, it seems that that very groundlessness, that very sense of confusion is the first step. When I first met Trungpa Rinpoche and we established a community here, he first started to have us sit in meditation, and he had everybody sit on the edge of the room facing out. And I, at the time, was still very much attached to Suzuki Roshi and the Zen style of meditation in which you sit with the wall in front of you. So I said to Trungpa Rinpoche, who I hadn't quite accepted as a teacher yet, he was penetratingly accurate about me, but I couldn't quite accept his personality, especially next to Suzuki Roshi, who was so pristinely Japanese, till they finally met, and that sealed my fate. They became best friends on the spot. Nonetheless, I said to Rinpoche, I said, would it be all right if I just kept on facing the wall? And he said, that would be fine. You can just keep on facing the wall. So everybody was facing out, and I was sitting there, you know, facing the wall with my kind of very stiff, almost militant form of Zen meditation, until one day I got lonely and I turned around. So whatever you were doing, he seemed to trust people's basic inspiration and trust that they would figure out how to work through situations themselves. He had this immense trust in people's basic intelligence. In the process of meditation, then, of course, the idea is to be fully present and accepting of whatever arises in your mind, in your experience, while sitting a certain way, which is attentive, watchful, and being supported by practicing a technique that constantly brings you back from wandering. And in a way, that coming back from wandering again and again and again through labeling thoughts, coming back, recognizing that you've been away even for a second or an hour, in itself seems to cut that tendency to want to create an alternative. Brings you right back to square one, which is whatever's occurring in your mind, what is. And it seems to be the tactic of spiritual materialism that it feeds on a past and a future. A future in terms of a goal, a past in terms of memories or inspirations that you'd like to continue. So, in the process of meditation, then those are cut away. Each time one remembers to come back, to just be present in the moment. And what you're left with is exactly the structure, the pattern, the tendency of spiritual materialism, but stripped bare, naked. And the shaky confidence that comes about with constantly referring to the past and the future becomes even more confused for a while because of the lack of reference point. But in that confusion, there seems to be some intelligence that starts to shine through, that starts to see through that those are very conditional ways of approaching the world, to constantly refer to the past, to me and that, any goal orientation, any sense that what you're doing on the spiritual path is to accomplish something else other than what's going on directly in the mind. Whether that it's relating to one's job or whether it's relating to one's emotions or one's thoughts constantly coming back. And over time, of course, then that process of constantly reinforcing our expectations starts to fall apart a bit, and there's the experience of some gap in that whole seamless process of what we call ego. And what we thought we're supposed to be less of, that ego itself starts to just fall apart a bit. And in the process of falling apart, we see what makes it work to begin with. And in the process of seeing how it works, there's a certain sense of perspective or space in which there's no territory. And Trungpa Rinpoche would refer to that space as a feeling of groundlessness, a feeling of a bit of coming undone, but definite groundlessness and confusion. And that's a hint as to how to meditate, to be willing to be in that space of uncertainty, which on the other hand is also the space of openness. I remember in my first meditation, maybe second meditation instruction with Trungpa Rinpoche, we were sitting all day long in his house, which was in Four Mile Canyon, and we had the opportunity to go in and spend 2 or 3 minutes having an interview with Rinpoche during the course of the day, during the meditation. I was still very much attached to the Zen style of sitting, although I had turned around. And I went in, and he said, "Let me see your meditation." So I put on my best Zazen posture and, tried to do my best. And he kicked the hell out of me into my ankle, and it really hurt. And so I was immediately very confused, the first impulse was a little bit defensive. And why did you do that? You're a Buddhist teacher. And yet trying to figure out why the hell he did that. And when I was completely flustered in the moment, he said, "That! Meditate like that!" So then, as soon as he said that, I tried to recollect myself and figure out what the lesson was, and he said, "No!" And then he kicked me again, and I would get flustered again, and then I'd try to figure out what the lesson was, and he said, "No!" After 2 minutes, I said, "Rinpoche, I am completely confused." And he says, "Good, go back and sit with your confusion." And I've been doing that ever since. At some point, cutting through spiritual materialism seems to make a flip in terms of what it means to cut and what materialism is. So at first it almost seems to be like a doctrinal issue, is our attitude, is our approach to the spiritual path something that needs to be adapted in a way that we have the right attitude in going to the spiritual path, and that's necessary. It's kind of a conceptual, nonetheless, it leads one into meditating in a way and reminding oneself when one finds oneself once again in more subtle and subtle levels trying to use the path for some kind of gain or some kind of goal. So it does seem to be a necessary stage, very much so. But at some point, the lesson starts to becoming something that haunts one's practice, I think, in the sense that less and less does it seem to be the point to exercise some kind of ambition in terms of cutting through, some kind of ambition to understand what materialism is so that we can see through it to something more basic, more open. And in that moment, those insights of kind of letting go of that, then there seems to be the experience of a greater space in one's awareness. So it's a bit like saying that at first you start to trust your own intelligence, and then after a while your own intelligence flips and starts to trust you. And there's less of a sense of project that you're using your intelligence to somehow get somewhere, and more of just, you might say, giving up and opening out on the spot because of the lack of supports that come from your usual thought processes. And interestingly enough, it seems to come about with the same attitude that starts to be more generous with one's thought process, to be less judgmental, to let your thoughts come and go, and yet not to have to follow them or suppress them. So, at some point, the cutting itself seems to change the quality, and as Rinpoche says, at that point, cutting is more a sudden penetration into the heart of the matter. Sudden penetration into the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter being whatever one's experience is in that moment, without expectation nor demand. And simultaneously, I think that the whole project orientation of cutting through spiritual materialism starts to transform as well into a sense of irony, in a sense of humor, where in perspective, all those attempts that we so habitually have been inclined to do, that we experience so vividly in meditation, start to become funny, as though they're a play act that somewhere along the way we took seriously and identified with completely, but now we see that it's an act and a play. It's a way that we've been behaving for a long time, and it becomes more transparent. At that point, it's also not necessary, I think, to identify what materialism is that has to be cut through, but in that space, whatever comes up in your mind is what you work with. Whatever mood, whatever emotion, whatever thought comes up, it comes up of its own accord, whether it's because of our habitual past or because of sense stimuli or memories, whatever, it just arises. And that's what we work with on the spot through meditation, through our attitude. So it's no longer a matter of having to kind of figure out where the hard point is and then cut through it, but it's a matter of just being open to our experience, which is the heart of the matter. And the cutting, likewise, becomes more generous. It's a sense of seeing things in perspective. As far as ego goes, it's somewhat of a rarefied environment. So an example would be, on one hand, if somebody's doing a spacewalk and they rub up against a sharp edge in a spacecraft and it cuts their oxygen line, you might say that, it's a sudden emergency. But from the point of view of space, it's just space being space. You are just kind of trying to do something different in space, but it's not like space is sitting there waiting until your wind supply is cut and then it kind of rushes in to destroy you. It's just a matter of the nature of space. One way that I can think of my own personal experience in experiencing that was that I found that the few times that I did have personal interviews with Trungpa Rinpoche, that there would be a long, no matter whether I knew about it 3 days ahead or 2 months ahead, every day there was kind of a build-up to it. And I would try to refine my question to take the best advantage of that time that I would go in to see him for 10 or 15 minutes or 5 minutes. So I would really kind of work with myself and come up with the basic issues, the basic point that would really help my practice, that I could, derive an answer, or the most kind of haunting question that I had. Or if I had a doubt about him, how I could present it to him, what's this about? What are you doing that for? And every time, as soon as I walked into the room, I would completely forget what I'd so carefully prepared and refined and honed. It would just completely leave my mind. And I would completely be just struggling to try to come up with something. And, you know, later on I tried to figure, what did he do? But he didn't do anything. He just sat there. But there was a quality of spaciousness in which you couldn't even enter with your question and rob the space. It just kind of dissolved on the spot like spit on a hot griddle, as they say. And there you were, being left feeling very naked. And you come up with something. Usually it would be a very kind exchange, very brief. Maybe a question here and there that would pop up, but then you know, by the time I left the room, I usually forgot what I had asked and what the answer was. But somehow it became apparent to me that in that environment, whatever reaction I had was my answer. Whatever reaction of groundlessness or being befuddled or was always accompanied by the sense of spaciousness, and therefore it was exactly what I needed to work with. So I would go back and meditate, and somehow that in itself would be instructive. And I think the one more one meditates than that in itself becomes the cutting through spiritual materialism, that you experience that space, and then you experience the pattern of ego coming up once again, and its particular appropriation of that space, which is somewhat humorous and somewhat sad, but nonetheless, it also has an endearing character of being something of your own personality. And in that regard, it is your path. And in that way, you gradually go through many, many different possibilities. Trungpa Rinpoche described meditation as like unpeeling an onion, where you peel one layer after another layer after another layer. Eventually, you get to the middle of the onion where there's no more layers, but there's no more onion either. So the dynamic of cutting through spiritual materialism, you might say, has its negative aspects, its positive aspects, but it seems to be something fundamental that at first seems to be a project, but then ends up being an expression of your own innate intelligence and your own innate appreciation of the spaciousness that surrounds any situation. Now, what do you do from there? How do you go further with cutting through spiritual materialism, if it is indeed something that you do for the rest of the entire spiritual path without any goal in mind from moment to moment? And ironically, that seems to be next week's subject, which is surrender and devotion as the expression of that kind of egolessness intelligence. Part of that, I think, is that Trungpa Rinpoche, on one hand, was very critical about those aspects of Tibetan Buddhism that captured people in terms of fascination, or which people kind of craved after. But sometimes there's a misunderstanding that he was condemning his tradition, that somehow everything went wrong in Tibet because of the arising there of spiritual materialism, which it certainly did, and which Trungpa Rinpoche was very honest about as having perhaps contributed to the environment in Tibet, leading to its vulnerability to outside attack. The breakdown of genuine spirituality into kind of territoriality and sectarianism, and then finding different expressions of that in the West. Nonetheless, this is the matrix of spiritual practice that he came out of. And not for a moment did he ever neglect to feel deep devotion to his own teachers and the purity of his tradition. And when the time came and he felt people were rooted in this approach of egolessness as the main point, he introduced his students to those people from Tibet that he felt really expressed the tradition of meditation, trusting also that his students would be able to see through anybody who showed up with a robe on and was trying to make a lot of money off giving you a lot of initiations and promising you a lot of things. So My sense of it was that at some point, your attitude, your approach to your practice of cutting through spiritual materialism starts to transform into the language of egolessness so that you can hear the teachings. You can hear the teachings of egolessness, and you can start to relate to the lineage of people who have practiced that and had some realization of that. And in that regard, there was a tremendous amount of trust. Not only that, but an injunction by Trungpa Rinpoche that if you were to have one teacher and one teacher only, that there was a very strong danger that you would become fixated in a way that that teacher becomes an even bigger form of spiritual materialism, and it becomes a personality cult. So that one of the remedies for that is to communicate with the wider lineage and to make sure that you continue to be nurtured by the larger world of egolessness communication. All right. Those are a few suggestions about the topic, but I would like to invite any questions or discussions, and particularly if anybody disagrees with me, I would be very grateful that I'm wrong. Hi, Cassell.
Hi, Clark. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. We met in a kitchen in Vienna, and I was surrounded by people speaking German, and suddenly this Mississippi accent says, "Hi, who are you?"
That's right, at Isabella Ernst.
Yeah.
That's right. Wow. Ding dong. I'm curious about Rinpoche saying about not having only one teacher and being fixated on that teacher, because I don't remember that. I mean,
I can give you the text reference later.
Okay.
And it came up also just in terms of his bringing Karmapa here and Kensei Rinpoche here. And
yeah, no, I see the you know way it played out, but I was just wondering if there was a reference.
There is, and I can give it to you.
Very interesting to me. Yeah. Okay, good. Thanks.
Oh, there's a spider on my notes.
Just kind of an echo of Cassell's comment in a way, just because he stressed so much not shopping around for teachers too. It was really interesting to hear that aspect that you just brought up. So that was interesting. Also, I was just reminded when you were talking about how at some point you realized Rinpoche really did give the traditional teachings. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time, I don't think I ever really doubted that. But then at some point after he had died, I remember when I was in France and Kensei Rinpoche was teaching in Dordogne. And he taught the Mahayana slogans that we had studied with the Vidyadhara. And, you know, they were being taught in Tibetan and they were being translated. And I remember sitting there in that tent, which kind of sloped upwards as a wooden floor, and we didn't have cushions. It was really hard to sit up straight because you were kind of leaning against this wooden floor going up. And I remember realizing when I was listening to the slogans being taught that he had taught us the real slogans. And it somehow I hadn't realized that up until that point, I somehow thought he was adapting it so much for us that maybe we weren't getting the kind of normal teachings of Buddhism. And it was actually kind of shocking, I remember, when I realized, well, oh, he did give it to us straight. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to, that was like 1990, I think, 3 years after.
You know, sometimes the way that he presented even a traditional topic like the Four Foundations of Mindfulness was so unique that I think it was Jules or somebody who was a translator tried like crazy to find out where he got that approach to it. So it's combing through volumes and volumes of Tibetan and the treasury of knowledge and this and that, and never found it. And yet when Trungpa Rinpoche himself was asked about that, he said, well, you know, academically, you know, it's presented like this, but this is the way it's actually experienced. So I think there's that lineage that he very much represents of direct experience in what's called the oral tradition, in which the sense of the topic is has evolved over even, you know, 2,500 years, and been refined and polished and also culturally presented in different ways. And but also, I think the Trungpa Rinpoche shot from the hip. And I don't think there's any contradiction between the two. That's what I meant, in a way. That now there may be debates and different angles on the whole topic matter, but that's, you know, the history of Buddhism, which is enthralling for people who are, you know, like me, who get fixated on things like that. But nonetheless, I think he shot from the hip, and he made a very interesting comment once, which haunts me daily. He said, "Nowness is the dwelling place of the ancestors," which I think explains lineage on one dot. Yeah. In terms of the other thing that you said, I think it's interesting, of course, spiritual shopping and looking to collect teachings from lots of different teachers is exactly what he was pointing towards as being rampant spiritual materialism. And yet, the notion of genuine communication with lineage holders who could deepen your sense of the teaching seemed to be something genuine. And I think at some point he really trusted his students to tell the difference between that in a way that he trusted us in so many ways. But nonetheless, one has to take each situation as it comes, I suppose. As far as I could tell, Trungpa Rinpoche loved the material world. He was very playful with the material world. So cutting through materialism didn't particularly have anything to do with disregarding the material world. But, oh, I was hoping that would spark something in you, Sherub.
I wonder why you keep referring to it as the material world. Do you think he would have done so?
He referred to it as the phenomenal world, yeah. Didn't he?
Yeah. I don't think he ever thought of it as material.
Yes, that's a good point. But the phenomenal world, yeah.
Nothing to do with materialism at all.
Yeah. Very good point.
Clark, what do you think he was really trying to do with our minds? I mean, he was very threatening, and we were Western minds, and, you know, we weren't quite into the self-improvement then that we are now, but he obviously was good at breaking up our conceptions. But what was he, when he looked at us, when he heard the way we talked, what was he really trying to do?
Well, the question is, I suppose, you know, was he trying to do anything?
Mm-hmm.
Or was he just responding from his own mind, from his own insight to situations as they came up? I remember feeling very frustrated at some point and had an interview with him, and it was one of the few interviews where I actually remembered the conversation. And I said, we must all seem extremely foolish to you because you give very profound teachings and yet it seems like we just keep on missing the point and again and again and again. So why do you put up with us? And he said, I see both simultaneously. I said, what? And he said, I see your confusion and your insight and your brilliance simultaneously. And that inspires me to work with you. That's what he said. But maybe somebody else can address that question. What was he trying to do with our minds? What was your experience of what he was trying to do with your mind?
Settling, and I felt like my entire—I mean, my existence was being called into question. Everything was just like that, like when you're on a plane and there's a sinking feeling. You just it was terrifying in some way.
So why didn't you leave?
Why didn't or why did I?
Oh, I see.
I sort of did leave, but a lot got in before I left. A lot of his teaching got in and it never left.
What was it that kind of stayed with you?
Well, I think that sense of, I remember him sitting up here, you know, and talking about make a home in space and hopelessness and fearlessness, and that sense of the gaping void that he opened up when he challenged our sense of identity made you see the superficiality of the identity that I had constructed for myself. So there was some truth that you couldn't, that I was attracted to. Mm-hmm.
When I was in junior high school, I had a paper out, and I had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to bundle the papers and then go out and throw them. And while I was bundling them, it was terribly lonely and dark time of the day. So I turned on the radio, and the only program that was on was this kind of schmaltzy romantic music program where they played nothing but really schmaltzy, super schmaltzy romantic tunes. And they started out with this really schmaltzy expression. He introduced it. And, at the time I thought, why the hell am I listening to this crap every week? And then I just realized it was something to get me going in the morning, but it stuck with me somehow. And the expression was, when the program started, this voice with a deep velvety feeling came on and said, "Why do I love you? I love you not only for what you are, but for what I am when I am with you." So I suppose you could do the same thing for hate. It's interesting, ancestor worship has always been an interesting thing to me. I thought at first, why do the Chinese, worship their dead relatives? But of course, that's a very, skewered American view of it. And I always felt there must be something deeper, about what ancestor worship is about. And then my father died just over a year ago. And I was thinking about this when Peter said last week that he felt that Trungpa Rinpoche died, but then something about him didn't die. And I realized that for a long time, it's continuing now, after my father's death, I feel he's even more there than he was when he was alive. Because I could always shuffle our relationship off into, disagreements from high school or, where we could get along and compromise, and it all had some kind of way of shuffling and sorting things out. But once he was gone, it was just, that feeling of his presence. And I realized our relationship with anybody is so impregnated with our own experience of the situation. And sure, there's communication, but we really suppose this whole thing that somebody's an other. And we're experiencing things really in terms of our own impressions so strongly. And then we project that person as the other. So those basic impressions of my father continued. And I realized, ancestor worship has some kind of validity in a way, because what your ancestors or what your father or your mother are kind of continue as part of you, as part of your mind. And in a way, I felt Trungpa Rinpoche perhaps transmitted something different than my father did. But still, that dynamic continued, where you feel those are alive because it becomes something that haunts you, or that something that informs your view of the world and pops up in a way. So it pops up in a fresh way with each instant, but nonetheless, it heralds back to that kind of process of communication that happens in a concrete way to begin with. I did not bury my father under my living room floor. Oh. There was a tradition in China at some point of burying your ancestors under your living room floor, you know, to have the ancestors close. So. That's all I meant. Richard. Richard and I did our first acid trip together. In Sunshine Canyon in 1967. And then we didn't see each other for 40 years. Till last week.
And I remember you took notes.
I couldn't read them afterwards.
Showed them to me in the morning and realized you'd forgotten to move down a line every time you wrote.
I think that's where we coined the phrase, everything dissolves into peanut butter.
It wasn't peanut butter that we referred to.
Oh.
Everything dissolves in acid was your quotation.
But then I remember looking at the peanut butter and thinking the same thing.
You know, when I was in high school, I was a Boy Scout, and we were really into collecting merit badges. And I found when I became a hippie, we were still into collecting merit badges, but they were kind of anti-merit badge, merit badges. So I had an experience of Rinpoche, as well as kind of seeing through that whole merit badge collection process. I don't know how much of his teachings were essential to the way he taught or grounded in the times. You know, his spiritual competition was people like Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. So, you know, lots of merit badges, it seemed, in that tradition. So I found his disturbingness actually fresh, though not undisturbing. Mm-hmm.
The first year of Naropa, of course, Ram Dass and Trungpa Rinpoche were the two headliners. And one night Trungpa Rinpoche would teach, and Ram Dass would teach the next night, and Ram Dass would, you know, teach that everything is one, and that Trungpa Rinpoche and our approach is fundamentally one, there's no conflict. And then Trungpa Rinpoche would teach the next night, and he'd say, no, it's very different, we're not one. And it went on like that for the whole summer, and Ram Dass finally said, I give up. So, well, you know, one of the liabilities of the Buddhist path is there is an element of getting merit badges. And merit's a big thing. Now, of course, it's qualified as being, you know, rather than just going after the goodies, that you're trying to build up a bank of positive karma, or whatever you want to call it, such that it will inform your spiritual path, and it will provide a right opportunity and right insight for your spiritual path. But then, of course, at some point, the whole issue of merit badges came up again, and even having to disassociate or adopt merit itself was seen as something that needed to be dropped. Anything else this evening? Yes.
I don't have any idea, actually. What you were referring to about merit badges in that tradition of Mahesh Yogi. So I just wondered if you could clarify that for me.
Were you in it?
Sure, and it really has nothing to do with him. It was really more the sense of the times, and so my wondering was about Rinpoche's reaction to the times. But those of us who were long-haired hippies, it was kind of, who has the longest hair, who can be the most rebellious, who can live without any substance, the most anti-culturally, and or be the most peaceful, or like in the way you depicted Ram Dass, who's got lots of rich complexity, actually. You know, you could see him as just all flowers and light. How close could you be to that? So really a very strong sense of spiritual materialism, of, you know, using spirituality as a basis for constructing or holding up your ego, especially if your identity was contradictory to the identity that you had held up previously. Does that make any sense? So, you know, we kind of had, as a counterculturalists, we kind of developed counter-identities, but that didn't make them any less identities, or didn't make them any less of a box, just a different box. Does that clarify what I was trying to say?
So you're not saying that there wasn't also some genuine spirituality happening around that particular yogi? He was probably also trying to cut through people's spiritual trips, I would assume, and there was some genuineness depending on the person or the circumstance. Just like Trungpa was also having to confront that counterculture.
He confronted it. He worked with it in a different way, I suppose. I wasn't a follower of Maharishi, so I don't know the details of how that worked.
I think we'll end for tonight. Thank you very much. And next week, Mr. Volz will be speaking about lineage and devotion and how that was approached by Trungpa Rinpoche. So thank you for coming tonight. Good evening.